From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Big money, secrecy, and control of the Congress. Hello again, I'm Oren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Tea Party movements made big headlines, but the big news in this year's congressional races will be money, lots of it. The Supreme Court has legalized unlimited campaign spending by corporations and unions, and corporate America is hoping to change control of the Congress. Right now, Democrats have more cash on hand, but corporate support for Republicans will be massive, and contributors can remain anonymous. Money and secrecy can be a potent political combination. We'll talk about their potential impact on November's midterm elections. On Reporter's Notebook, Wyclef Jean says the time has come for him to save the people of Haiti. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. This year's November elections may be dominated by a combination of money and secrecy. Will the Democrats be able to hang on to control of the Congress? On Reporter's Notebook, the hip-hop superstar Wyclef Jean says his native country can't wait any longer for him to return. We'll hear about his likely candidacy for president of Haiti. First, this news update. More than 100 days after the Deepwater Horizon exploded, BP says the so-called static kill finally has been successful. At the same time, federal officials say three-quarters of the oil that's been spilled is now dispersed or removed from the water. Speaking to labor leaders in Washington, here's how President Obama reacted.
The long battle to stop the leak and contain the oil is finally close to coming to an end. And we are very pleased with that. Our recovery efforts, though, will continue. We have to reverse the damage that's been done.
President Obama at the meeting of the AFL-CIO in Washington. Brian Walsh has been following oil spill developments for Time magazine. And, Brian, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
President sounds optimistic, but a quarter of the oil is still unaccounted for.
That's right. I mean, a quarter of the oil is still the equivalent of, I believe, something like five Exxon Valdez spills. So it's still out there. I mean, NOAA, the government agency that put together this report, says, you know, the oil is mostly sheen, that they don't think it's likely to be doing a lot of damage. Certainly, it seems the shore, at the very least, the shoreline was able to escape a lot of the damage that we'd been worried about before. But on the whole, this is still pretty good news.
The dispersants, too, though, are out there. And we didn't hear anything this morning about that.
No, I mean, they did calculate that the dispersants may have accounted for something like 8% of the oil, I mean, in terms of actually dispersing it to the point where it disappeared. So, you know, for almost 2 million gallons of chemical dispersants used, that doesn't seem to be a great payment for your money. And actually right now, Congress there's a Senate hearing just today talking about, again, those health impacts of dispersants, while the EPA came out with a report earlier this week saying, we still really believe that these dispersants are mostly non-toxic. There's still concerns, because we've never used this much, what that's going to do over the long term.
What about the static kill? That isn't the last word in stopping the well itself, is it?
No, I mean, Thad Allen, the retired Coast Guard admiral who's been running the show for the federal government, has said repeatedly that this is only done when the relief well is finished. That's likely to be sometime in the middle of August. So BP has been successful in putting down enough mud that you're actually you create what's actually known as a static situation. That's where the name comes from, where the pressure from the mud is equal to the pressure from the oil. So there's no oil flowing, even if you remove the capping sack that's on there right now. But to really kill that well, you have to put concrete, cement and concrete in, and that's something that only can be done really with the relief well.
Well, now the president just said we have to reverse the damage that has been done. Is it going to be possible to reverse the damage?
It's going to be difficult. I mean, this is the Gulf. The Gulf of Mexico already is an area that was under a lot of environmental stress well before this oil spill happened. I mean, out in the water you have the dead zones, of course, which are the result mostly of agricultural runoff flowing into the Gulf of Mexico. Those are getting almost bigger every year. You have a lot of coastal damage, coastal erosion damage, especially in Louisiana. Again, partially the result of all the levees that have been built and partially the result of a lot of canals that have been actually created for oil and gas. Reversing that is going to be incredibly difficult. Hopefully, all this money that's flowing into this and all the science that'll be flowing into this problem will actually be going not just to understanding what the oil has done, but actually trying to create a better Gulf of Mexico.
What about the money, though, to do all this reversing of damage? BP isn't responsible for all of the damage that's been done in the past, particularly the building of the canals and the diversion of the Mississippi River.
That's actually absolutely true. I mean, we've heard so many times the promise we heard after Katrina, which, of course, is its five-year anniversary is coming up soon, that you know it's in the country's interest to really try to spend to try to fix these problems. It never really gets done. There's certainly not enough money in what BP is putting out there to do this kind of wide-scale coastal restoration that we're talking about. I mean, they're going to be stressed just getting the money to the people who need it in terms of the claims process. So we'll really have to see whether President Obama is going to live up to what he said in terms of actually leaving the Gulf better than it was before the spill.
You don't specialize in politics, but let me ask you this. Some Republicans are calling this Obama's Katrina. Are they going to be able to make that stick, do you think, between now and November?
Well, I don't think it should have ever stuck, for one thing. I mean, while there were definitely problems with the federal response to this, and a lot of which stems from the fact that the government still had to be reliant on BP to be doing most of the work and the expertise of the cleanup, I think we'll look back and say that they did a relatively good job. And certainly now that it's no longer seems to be, at least on the surface of it, the disaster that we've been concerned about over the past 100 days or so, I think you know he could actually possibly look back upon this and say, look, we did the best we could with a situation that was very difficult, and it's something you should in some ways even feel proud of, possibly.
In the meantime, what about fisheries, and how soon does it appear that they will be open? Will some of them now still be closed for a long time?
Well, you're already seeing NOAA begin to reopen areas of the Gulf that have been closed for fishing. I think something like 25% is still off limits. That's likely to continue to you see more and more opening of waters. And at that point, we'll see, really. I mean, on one hand, you know, the fish here have had essentially a fishing moratorium for almost the entire summer. You may even see better populations for a while. On the other hand, what we know from the Exxon Valdez, you can have long-term impacts on fish populations years after an oil spill. It's possible that especially if you saw a class of larvae, a generation of larvae being hit by that oil at a sensitive time, they could be wiped out, and that we might not know how serious that impact is for a couple of years.
Okay, something of concern to consumers around the country. Tom Hamburger, Brian Walsh, environmental reporter with Time Magazine, thanks a lot for being with us. In a moment, big money, secrecy, and control of the Congress on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Mormon Alney back with To the Point. For months, the Tea Party movement has dominated political news, but with a few exceptions, its candidates have not done very well. That trend continued yesterday in primary results from Michigan, Missouri, and Kansas. The 800-pound gorilla in November's final elections will be unlimited campaign spending by corporations and unions, legalized by the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling this January in the Citizens United case. Tom Hamburger reports from Washington for the Los Angeles Times, and Tom, it's good to have you back on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Good to be with you.
At the moment, it's being reported that Democratic candidates have more money on hand than Republican candidates do. How is the Citizens United decision expected to affect that?
Well, in competitive House races, it's true, Warren, that the most recent disclosures from the Federal Election Commission show that Democratic candidates have outraised their Republican opponents, on average $500,000 or so. One of the concerns, particularly among Democratic leaders who've worked so hard to establish that record, is that Citizens United decision allows for corporations and unions to contribute unlimited sums to independent political activity in these races. And so $500,000 could be dwarfed by a corporate CEO or a union executive who decides at the last minute or at any point during a campaign to write a check for any multiple of that amount.
Now, when you say independent activity, that means they still, corporations and union, can't directly contribute to a given campaign, but they can engage in campaign activity as long as it isn't coordinated with the campaign of the candidate himself.
Correct. Coordination is the key. Unlimited amounts of money can be spent and contributed and can be used in the political fray, but as you just suggested, it cannot be coordinated with the candidate.
What is the indication so far about who's got the momentum, the corporations or the unions?
Well, it is early, but there is a sense from our survey recently of the business organizations, many of them based in Washington, and also individual CEOs that we talked to around the country, that that CEOs are prepared and businesses are prepared to spend this election cycle, and since they have an opportunity to do so without the restraints that applied in years past, the momentum seems to be with the business groups, at least for the moment. That, of course, could change, but that's the way it's looking now, Warren, for several reasons.
Which business groups, and what kind of money are we talking about?
Well, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is probably the most outspoken and the most well-known of the business trade associations, and they have launched a very aggressive campaign plan for the midterm elections. In 2008, their campaign budget, electoral campaign budgets for this kind of expenditure, was about $35 million. At the beginning, a few months ago, they announced that they were going to increase it for 2010 to $50 million. And then just a couple of weeks ago, they announced that it would be going up to $75 million. So a huge increase over what was spent in 2008, a presidential election year. And the folks that we've talked to at the Chamber say they think they well may exceed that $75 million budget.
And they have said, we asked them to come on our program, they declined our invitation. But they have said in the past that what they're interested in is changing control of the Congress.
Yes, and they're saying that even more explicitly now, I would say. While the Chamber is officially a nonpartisan organization, they are concerned, as they say their members are, about an anti-business climate, which has taken over Washington, a town now where the Democrats control both the legislative and executive branches, of course. And so the plan is to at least try to reset things a little bit so that business has a stronger voice and can influence some of the policy and regulatory decisions that chamber members are concerned about.
Here's a quote from Bill Miller, the chamber's political director. He says, you could spin the wheel of industry and probably not land on a number for an industry that doesn't believe they have been kind of attacked by this Congress. He says the members of the chamber are looking to us and others to try to help reset the composition of Congress. There certainly are, though, a lot of pro-business Democrats, as President Obama and the Democratic leaders have found out.
Warren, that's right, and I've talked with some members of Congress, one member of the Senate, who was saying, you know, the chamber was up here lobbying us. Both the chamber did support the initial stimulus proposal from the White House, also the automobile bailouts and other legislation, and there are Democrats who have voted with the chamber and have records that they think deserve support. But as Bill Miller said to me when we were talking a few days ago, business is motivated now, and part of the motivation comes from the actions of this Congress. Most recently, the Financial Services Regulatory Reform Bill, which has at least many of the Wall Street and investment community, Wall Street firms, investment community, and banks on edge about what kind of new regulation they're going to face. And so we're hearing these banks and financial firms are participating in ways, at least so far, that we haven't seen before.
Another interesting segment of industry is the coal operators. Tell us what they're planning to do.
Well, last week, Warren, several of us in the several news organizations received copies of an email that was sent from a West Virginia Appalachian Coal Company to several of its top officers of other companies suggesting forming a new organization to take advantage of this new Supreme Court decision. And the email suggested that it was really time to do something about this was an opportunity to do something about what the writer called the anti-coal environment in Washington that has been, I just quote to you one section of the email. This is from the Vice President of International Coal Group, said, The upcoming November elections are perhaps the most important for the country, for this industry, in a generation. The Obama administration and the Pelosi-Reid-controlled Congress have proven themselves to be fiercely anti-coal. With the recent Supreme Court ruling, we're in a position to be able to take our corporate positions that were not previously available in allowing our voices to be heard. And it calls for the formation of a new nonprofit organization which will spend on key congressional races.
And this is in the aftermath, of course, of the awful mining disasters that have occurred of late, particularly in the Massey coal mine. I take it Massey is one of the people that was on that email.
Massey is one of the four companies that was identified as in early talks to get this new nonprofit political organization going. We've since heard from the International Coal Group that they have had quite a positive response from other coal company executives, and they expect at a coal executives meeting in West Virginia coming up next week to begin formally pursuing this idea.
Tom Hamburger covers money and politics for the Los Angeles Times. In Washington, you indicated that the corporations have the momentum as opposed to the unions. Here's what President Obama said in January when the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court came down.
This ruling opens the floodgates for an unlimited amount of special interest money into our democracy. It gives the special interest lobbyists new leverage to spend millions on advertising to persuade elected officials to vote their way or to punish those who don't. That means that any public servant who has the courage to stand up to the special interests and stand up for the American people can find himself or herself under assault come election time.
Rick Hassan is a professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. He writes electionlawblog.org. And Rick Hassan, good to have you on our program.
It's my pleasure.
You agree with the president?
Well, the definition of special interest is really in the eye of the beholder. So whether or not you call the new corporate union mind that's coming in special interest, I think, is a decision each person can make. But I do think we're going to see much more corporate and potentially union involvement in this election compared to the last election. And this is especially so because of a development that occurred not when the Supreme Court decided Citizens United, but when the Federal Election Commission just a couple of weeks ago said that corporations could give their money to other committees rather than spend the money directly, so it's an ad paid for by Corporation X, they can now give it to a committee. And I think this is really significant because it's going to make it easier to hide your identity, and that will make corporations which are worried about their customers more willing to let their money go out in the political marketplace.
So in other words, then, they won't be identified as members of some committee, so-and-so for so good government or something of that kind.
Well, if you go and you actually go to the FEC website at some point, there will be a disclosure. But it will not be something that will be on the face of the advertising. So if Massey Coal is giving 99% of the money to the to this new nonprofit coal group, it's going to have the name of the coal group on the ad, and it's not going to say Massey.
When will the disclosure occur?
Well, there are periodic reports that get filed with the FEC. They get filed at regular intervals, and then close to the election, as money comes in at the last minute, those get filed pretty quickly. But the public rarely pays attention to that. What we know in California is that when the public pays attention to disclosure, it's when it's on the face of the ad. And I'd point you to the experience we just had in California with Proposition 16, which was a measure that PG&E, the utility, private utility, put on the ballot to try and prevent local government competition. That measure went down to defeat even though PG&E spent $40 million, almost all the money on the yes side to try and promote this. And I think it's because each ad on television and each ad on radio said paid for by this coalition, sponsored by PG&E.
Rick Hassan again, a professor at Loyola Law School, studies campaign law. Tom Hamburger, back to you. Who are in particular appears at this point to be offering anonymity to contributors?
Well, as Rick just pointed out, this question of anonymity is significant to donors and also to the organizations that want to collect money and run ads. So the Chamber of Commerce, which we were discussing a moment ago, is one that has led the way to fight legislation, including some that stalled in the Senate just last week, that would have required more disclosure of the individual donors to advertisements that show up to influence a political race. So the Chamber of Commerce is one. I should note that in the past, when lawsuits were filed on this question of anonymity, labor unions also joined in because they, too, raised funds for these politically related campaign spending from individuals and organizations that don't wish their names disclosed. So anonymity for fundraisers in the political realm seems to be a tool for raising big bucks and for getting that kind of participation.
You mentioned the Disclose Act hung up in the Senate for the moment.
Yes.
Isn't one of the issues there that the National Rifle Association and labor unions collectively have been excluded from the requirements for disclosure?
Well, that is correct, that there were some specific exclusions that were written in for those organizations. It's not across the board, as I understand it, Warren, but there is an exemption. There are exemptions which have drawn the ire of business groups, all the Republicans in the Senate, and others who oppose the idea of granting special exemptions just to win political support for disclosure legislation.
So, Rick Hassan, back to you at Loyola Law School. What's worse, not having any disclosure or having it occur late in the game, or having disclosure for some but not others?
Well, you know, it was a tough choice for the House Democrats, who decided to give this NRA exemption in order to get the bill through the House. And, it was interesting to see the position of U.S. PIRG, which first supported the law, then opposed the law, then supported the law again because of this very difficult choice. I think there's plenty of blame to go around that we're going to go into this election without adequate disclosure laws. You can blame the moderate Republicans who didn't come forward in the U.S. Senate to come up with a cleaner disclosure law that they would have gotten behind. And you could probably blame the Democrats, too, for coming up with a bill that not only dealt with disclosure, but tried to do a number of things that have gotten less publicity, including trying to reimpose the spending limit on certain kinds of corporations, including government contractors and U.S. subsidiaries of foreign corporations.
Didn't the Democrats also have something to do with exempting labor unions from the Disclose Act?
Well, what was exempted, as I understand it, in the House bill was transfers of money. You know, so one of the things that you try and do if you're trying to keep your the identity of the ultimate funders anonymous is you transfer money across a whole bunch of different organizations. And I think the House bill, as I understood it, had a provision that exempted some transfers between different branches of the same union. That provision was taken out of the latest version that the Senate was going to consider, but that still did not attract the support of Senators Snow or Collins or Brown, who were the ones that the Democrats were targeting in the Senate.
So, Tom Hamburger, back to you with the Los Angeles Times in Washington. What are the prospects for this act to pass?
Well, it's difficult to say, though. I think that there is an acknowledgement by its backers that they have the inability to woo some of those moderate Republicans to the bill in the Senate, so that the Republicans were able to maintain the 60 votes necessary to prevent a cloture from breaking a filibuster. Means that it looks pretty. The outlook is dim for this year. I talked the other day with Chris Van Hollen, who is the Maryland congressman who runs the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and he said, you know, we're now looking at Plan B if there are what he calls scurrilous ads that attack Democratic candidates or other candidates anonymously. He's hoping that there'll be an organized effort to call out the sponsors of the ads and try to use the bully pulpit, even the White House pulpit,
okay,
to require or force disclosure.
We're going to take a brief break. We'll come back and continue this conversation on Reporter's Notebook a bit later. Wyclef Jean says the time has come for him to run for president of Haiti. We'll hear about that. Check us out on Facebook. We have a To The Point page. Back in a moment with To The Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren and Olney back with To The Point, talking today about the Citizens United case, which has allowed unlimited spending by corporations and unions as long as they don't spend directly or contribute directly to candidates for Congress, and also the failure so far of what's called the Disclose Act that would require campaign ads and other political documents vehicles for campaign messages to disclose who paid for them. David Keating is executive director of the Club for Growth. That's a conservative anti-tax group. The Club for Growth was fined by the FEC for spending millions in unrestricted soft money on ads during the 2004 elections. But last month, that same FEC signed off on a proposal to do exactly the same thing in 2010. David Keating with the Club for Growth, good to have you on our program.
Well, thanks for having me.
What's happened? Sounds like evolution has occurred.
Well, I guess we're rediscovering the First Amendment, which is actually one of the clearest things in the Constitution when it says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech and so on. So, you know, the courts have looked at that and said this is pretty obvious and have issued some rulings, and the FEC has finally decided to follow what the court's interpretations here. So I applaud the FEC for doing that.
This is assuming that corporations have the same freedom of speech as individual citizens do.
Well, there's nothing in the Constitution that says Congress shall make no law except for corporations and unions and these other people who are residents and citizens of the United States. Free speech applies to everyone. And I must say, I think the early part of the program has been very misleading. There's nothing at all about that these expenditures and donations are going to be not disclosed. They are disclosed. They're available on the Internet. They're available at the FEC website, the IRS website. This is public information. So I want to be sure the listeners are clear about that. There is no secret spending. There's no secret donations. When money is raised for express advocacy, when money is raised for an electioneering communication, it has to be disclosed. And all of the spending on express advocacy is always disclosed.
Now, let me introduce Tara Malloy, who's with the Campaign Legal Center. She litigates a wide range of campaign finance cases. And Tara Malloy, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
What do you say to this? Are they, in fact, disclosed, as David Keating says? Are we setting up a straw man of some kind here?
The problem is that the current law requires disclosure in only the most superficial sense. The issue is that corporations can give to another nonprofit group, and that nonprofit group can give to, for instance, an affiliated nonprofit group, and it's very difficult to trace the money under the current campaign finance laws. Essentially, the federal law requires groups only to disclose those contributors that give money specifically for the purpose of funding election ads. So if a person gives or a corporation gives money to the chamber as member dues, that is not something that will be disclosed, even if it's used entirely for an advertising campaign. So it's sort of the Russian doll problem. What happens when you have to trace the money through layer after layer of corporation or advocacy group or affiliates? And that was what Disclose was attempting to penetrate with better disclosure and disclaimers.
Again, Tara Malloy with the Campaign Legal Center. Back to David Keating with the Club for Growth. What do you say to that?
Well, I agree totally with the American Civil Liberties Union that attacked Disclose because it on a number of civil liberties issues. The Disclose Act would chill not only express advocacy on political candidates, but issue advocacy. It would fail to preserve the anonymity of small donors, and it would have chilled speech about any congressman after any primary in the country. And nonprofit groups, whether they're Sierra Club or some smaller group, would have had to go through all kinds of hoops and regulations to even mention the name of a candidate. So I don't understand. We have disclosure today. When money is raised for the purpose of influencing an election, that money has to be disclosed. And it is not, if something is earmarked through something else, that money has to be disclosed under the law. And that, I think, is a straw man here. If the money is given generally to the group, then why should that person have to be disclosed when the person is just supporting the group generally?
Well, it
doesn't make any sense to me. And it would put a whole host of new regulations on these groups, many of which currently are struggling to even stay alive.
Well, what about Tara Malloy talking about the Russian doll problem here and saying
it's
that...
It's not a Russian doll problem.
Well, let me finish.
If the money is given for influencing election, it has to be disclosed. The law is clear about that.
But it does and it doesn't, because if a corporation or a union contributes money, as I understand it, to some group that has the name, Citizens for Good Government or something of that kind, then you don't find out. There's no way for voters to find out which corporation or which union actually is behind
totally
it.
Incorrect.
Oh, okay.
If that group is set up to advocate or influence an election, that money has to be disclosed.
Tara Molloy, back to you. You argue this. I'm not the I'm not the advocate here.
Well, I think we're not really disagreeing. I think the problem is that we don't believe that a law that requires only the disclosure of contributions that are specifically earmarked for election activity is sufficient. For instance, the chamber doesn't disclose any of its donors, even though it makes very large expenditures on electioneering communications and express advocacy. They do so because they say they're using member dues, which were given generally, which, you know, may be the case, or maybe it's a case that it was given after a wink or a nod. Further, you know, there are various C4 groups that have to make very little disclosure at all, whose donors are essentially secret, except for reports to the IRS, which are not made public, and that just brings a further layer of a wall between the public and the actual donors to electioneering.
What about the ACLU that says this chills speech, not just for corporations that David Keating might be in favor of, but the Sierra Club and other organizations of that kind?
Well, that position is contrary to the very strongly expressed opinion of even this quite conservative Supreme Court. People tend to forget that although Citizens United destroyed one part of the law, that is the ban on corporate expenditures in elections, the decision also extolled the benefits of disclosure. So there's really no constitutional basis to claim that simple disclosure requirements, which simply bring public accountability to election spending, are necessarily chilling, and that has not been the position of the Supreme Court. Indeed, it's difficult to even find a Supreme Court case that has ever ruled against disclosure in the political sphere.
So the question comes down, it seems to me, to what you mean by a disclosure. Is the Supreme Court going to have to address that?
I think certainly if the Disclose Act passes, one would expect that we would see a lawsuit filed almost immediately. So I think it's probably just a matter of time to see whether we're going to get stronger disclosure requirements in the post-Citizens United world or not, to see whether we're going to have a Supreme Court pronouncement on that.
David Keating, would you agree with that? Should the court make a ruling on that?
Well, I think if the Disclose Act were passed, it would be ruled unconstitutional. It's a massive overreach. It does far more than simple disclosure. It, in fact, would enforce a group like the Sierra Club to essentially disclose every donor to ever made, period, and every other group. And there's no reason for that. It's a total overreach.
Now, Tara Molloy, is that right? Would the Sierra Club have to disclose all its membership lists? And would that, in fact, as the ACLU is suggesting, be a violation of their privacy?
That's absolutely not what the law does. I'd have to get into the technical details, but essentially a group can do a separate campaign-related account. And if they spend all through that account, they only need to disclose those contributors put into that account. If they spend with their general treasury funds, that is, if they don't set up a fully transparent account, then they might have to disclose some contributors that contribute above $600 or $1,000 to the group. So it's never the case at all. Members will have to be disclosed. And there's an easy, expedient way to avoid large disclosure by simply creating a transparent campaign-related activities account under the law.
All right. Let's stipulate for the moment that we're not going to resolve this controversy on this program. And Tara Molloy and David Keating have very different ways of looking at this. Let me go back to Rick Hassan, professor of law, Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, writes the electionlawblog.org. Tell us about Karl Rove and his campaign efforts and his promise of anonymity.
Well, yeah, this is very interesting. It does show the power of anonymity these days. Karl Rove announced that he and a group of other people were forming a group called American Crossroads, and they were going to raise something like $40 or $50 million to try and influence the 2010 midterm elections to Congress. Then a very anemic fundraising report came out from this group. It was set up as a 527. We can get into the details of what that is, but it was like a political committee, but reporting to the IRS instead of to the FEC. Didn't do well on fundraising until they set up an affiliated organization, American Crossroads GPS, which they set up as a 501c organization. And the difference there is that these organizations don't have to disclose anything publicly. Nothing gets posted on the IRS website, and all of a sudden, some very large donors stepped up. And money's coming in, and it's anonymous money. So I think it's a lesson that the more you can shield someone's identity, the more the money is likely to flow in.
So it's not then subject to the kind of disclosure that David Keating was talking about earlier?
Well, the 527 will have to disclose periodically to the IRS, and then that will be on the IRS website. But to the 501c organization, there will not be disclosure.
David Keating, back to you. Does that suggest that some contributors really want to be secretive?
Well, I'm sure some contributors do value their privacy, but this group is not a group that is going to be, as my understanding, is not going to be doing express advocacy, and certainly not very, if it does, it's going to be a tiny proportion of its budget. And if it raised money to do express advocacy, that money would clearly have to be disclosed under the law.
Tom Hamburger, back to you, Washington correspondent with the Los Angeles Times, covering money and politics. Tell us about the problems that Target got into in this context.
Well, Warren, quite apart from the jurisprudential discussion we're having about what the law might require concerning disclosure, in Minnesota in the last week, we've seen the consequences for one company that chose to contribute to a new organization set up after the Citizens United decision to collect large dollar contributions. Target Corporation, which owns Target stores and is based in the Twin Cities, gave $150,000 to a nonprofit group that is running ads under its name, backing a conservative Republican gubernatorial candidate, Tom Emmer, who opposes same-sex marriage. And that set off what was at first at least a small firestorm in Minnesota, particularly from gay and lesbian activists, but also from Democrats, or DFLers as they're known there in Minnesota. And it's since spread to a call by the MoveOn.org group for a nationwide boycott of Target. Not clear that there's any impact yet on the company's sales or stock price. On the contrary, we don't see any sign of a real impact there. But it has created at least a public relations problem for Target, for Target's contribution to have been revealed in this way. And so for some companies thinking of contributing to these groups and thinking they may do so anonymously, it's something of a cautionary tale about what happens when your donation becomes public.
So this suggests then that donations, that's a big donation, $150,000, are in fact disclosed.
Well, we're going to get into some of the legal details here, Warren, but as I understand it, the group that collected the money was one that was set up post-Citizens United under Minnesota law, which does require disclosure from its nonprofit group. So under Minnesota's law, the money given by Target and other large Minnesota corporations to this new group were disclosed, and that's how it was learned, through the state law. However, some of the private discussions that I've had with some of the corporate folks say, well, if Target had only donated, say, through the Chamber of Commerce, and they in turn had donated the money to Minnesota Forward, then, in fact, their participation would have been concealed.
Tara Malloy with the Campaign Legal Center. Is it important that state laws are very different from federal laws in terms of the kind of campaign issues we're talking about?
Well, I think that state laws and federal laws certainly diverge in certain points, but I think part of the confusion is stemming from whether or not the corporation gives to a quote-unquote political committee. These are special groups registered with the state or the federal FEC and have to disclose all their receipts and their disbursements. In that case, certainly, there would be disclosure of a corporation giving to a political committee. The problem is when corporations give to the 501c groups, the tax-exempt organizations such as the Chamber or such as various advocacy groups, then there is this wall that does create secrecy. And certainly, there might be different approaches in states versus the federal law, but there's always this continuing problem when money is given to, you know, the groups like Americans for America or so on and so forth.
David Keating, Executive Director of the Club for Growth. Is your organization, Club for Growth, designed to make contributions? Do you intend to collect money from members and then spend it on behalf of candidates in such a way that you don't have to reveal the names of the people who contributed to Club for Growth?
No. It's never been the case, and it won't be going forward. In fact, we asked the Federal Election Commission and got an advisory opinion from them to set up a special account for independent expenditures only, and all donations to this account will be disclosed, and all the spending, of course, will be disclosed. And that's how we plan to do all of our independent expenditures, total transparency. And I think given the simplicity of this model and given the fact that you're allowed to speak to anyone in the country about what you'd like to do to raise the money for and how you'd like to spend it, that most groups will copy essentially our model because it allows totally free speech. This idea that people are going to give to C4s with a nod and a wink is extremely dangerous legally. totally against the law to give money earmarked for express advocacy and not to report the contribution. And so I think people are going to copy our model, and the vast majority of the money used for express advocacy, meaning vote for or against this candidate, is going to be disclosed.
Tara Malloy, any problem with that?
Well, I think it's funny. If I understand Mr. Keating properly, he's creating a system that's something like what the Disclose Act would have imposed. Essentially, the act simply said, look, if you are an advocacy group, you create a separate campaign-related activity account. You fund all your election ads through this account. You only have to disclose in connection to that account. So that's really all that the law was really going to require. So it's interesting that the Club for Growth seems to be following this model.
So, David Keating, why do you object then to the disclosure?
But it's not true that that's what the law would require. If a group decided at the last minute or after this bill passed that suddenly it wanted to say something about a candidate, just say anything about the candidate, it would have had to disclose all of its donors. And that's a fact. And, you know, I think that's a total overreach by the law, and it's why not a single Republican voted for this law. It was a total overreach, and it totally favored unions over corporations. And I think Target's experience is instructive. I think all this idea that corporations are going to dump money on elections is way, way overstated, because they are concerned with selling product and keeping customers happy.
Again, Rick Hassan, back to you. Final question. Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Isn't that true? And aren't corporations tough political situations under these circumstances, as the Target story suggests?
I think it depends on the corporation. So if you're an ideological corporation, like, equivalent to the Club for Growth, there's no problem. If you're the coal industry, people don't decide, well, how much coal am I going to buy today to heat my house? I think no problem. It's only for in the consumer industry, you know, if it's Pepsi or Google or Target, where I think they're going to be much more inclined, if this uproar continues, to go through the chamber and to go through other organizations. But the money's still going to come in. With the Disclose Act not there, you know, I think, and now with the ability to make unlimited contributions to innocuous-sounding named committees, we're going to see a lot more money coming in, if not in 2010, certainly by 2012.
Okay, we've stipulated we don't have agreement on this, but David Keating, very quickly, if you will, we began this program saying it's the objective of many organizations on the conservative side to change the leadership in the Congress, in the majority in the Congress. Is that your hope, too?
Well, probably to change the leadership in the minority, too. We want pro-economic growth policies. We'd like both parties to do it. We'd like the Democrats to get back to the Clinton pro-free trade agenda, the pro-JFK tax-cutting agenda. So we don't care which party does it, as long as it does the job to help create jobs in the U.S. And I do want to say that I think it's great to have more speech about elections so we'll get more people interested to find out more about the candidates and getting out to vote. So I think more speech is going to be good in the long run.
David Keating, Executive Director for the Club for Growth. Tara Malloy with the Campaign Legal Center. Rick Hassan at Loyola Law School. Tom Hamburger with the Los Angeles Times. And many thanks to all of you for being with us today on our program. Wyclef Jean is a Haitian-American hip-hop superstar who now says the earthquake in his native country on January the 12th has turned him into a modern-day Moses, destined to return and lead his people out of bondage. We'll hear what he told Time magazine about running for president of Haiti in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Here's what audiences around the world are used to hearing from Wyclef Jean.
Instead of spending billions on the war, I can use that money so I can feed the poor. Because I know some so poor. When it rains, that's when they shower, scream and fight the power. That's when the vulture devours. If I was president, I get elected on Friday, assassinated on Saturday, buried on Sunday, they go back to work on Monday.
Wyclef Jean, If I Was President. Tim Padgett is Miami and Latin American Bureau Chief for Time magazine. He's in Port-au-Prince at the moment. Tim Padgett, good to talk with you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. You have interviewed Wyclef Jean. He told you that he was going to announce that he would run for president. Now there's some talk that he may do that on Larry King Live.
Yes, I mean, his plans have been to announce this on Thursday after he returns to Haiti from New York. The reason that this all broke last night was that because a congressman who's allied with Wycliffe sort of blurted it out to some reporters here, and it hit the wires, and so we decided to run our story, which we had been waiting to run until he made his announcement 2 days from now.
He described himself to you, according to your report, as a modern-day Moses destined to return and lead his people out of bondage. He's the son of a Nazarene a preacher, so does that kind of conversation come naturally to him?
Well, I guess very much, and as I point out in the piece, I think the soul of hip-hop culture blends very well with the that sort of religious enthusiasm that he grew up with as the son of a preacher, and so it's I think that kind of that kind of language, as you point out, comes very easily to him, and he brandishes that kind of expression very effectively, particularly when he describes why he wants to run for president of a country that, even though he didn't grow up in, he's never really. He's never really left, emotionally.
Came to this country at the age of 9. That's why he's called Haitian American. What are his motivations for running? Why does he think that he's the person who can help that terribly beleaguered country?
Well, ever since growing up in New York and New Jersey as a Haitian American kid, I think he was a lot more conscious than many other Haitian American kids of the problems back in his native country. He came here to the United States at the age of 9, and he spent much of his life and his career trying to cast Haiti in a more positive light to foreigners. And I think after the earthquake, as he said to me, he was thinking of waiting another 10 years before, taking a step like this to run for president. He's only 37 years old. But the earthquake just showed him that he couldn't wait to roll. Felt that it was time for someone like him from the diaspora, who doesn't carry all of the sort of corrupt and, political baggage that so much of the leadership has. He just felt that it was time for someone like him, who may not have grown up in Haiti, but is still considers himself Haitian, and brings a lot of the benefits of growing up in America to what he does. He just felt that it was time for someone like him to step in and try to change things here.
You point out that the population of 9 million people of Haiti, half of that population is under the age of 25. You pointed out he's 37. No doubt a lot of hip-hop fans in Haiti. Does he have a real chance of winning if he gets on the ballot?
I think he does have a chance, largely because of that demographic fact that you just point out. This reminds me a lot of what we used to call the Hasta generation in Mexico. When democracy finally came to Mexico about 10 years ago, it was literally because half the population there was under the age of 25 as well. And when that kind of demographic phenomenon happens, you get most of your voters who are fed up with the old guard way of doing things, and I'm seeing that kind of phenomenon here in Haiti. So that's one of the big reasons I think that he does have a good, because he does have that younger cohort behind him.
We just heard him sing in the final lyric of that song, "A Welcome to Haiti," or excuse me, the album is "Welcome to Haiti." The song is "If I Were President." I'd get elected on Friday, assassinated on Saturday, and buried on Sunday. What does that say about the history of presidents of Haiti?
Well, when he recorded that song back in 2006, I think he may have also been sort of spoofing American politics. I think it was just a sort of a hip-hop vernacular way of saying, look, we don't want to take traditional and corrupt politics all that seriously. We want to bring a kind of a new model to places like Haiti. And if you the chorus there is sort of tongue-in-cheek, the chorus of that song, are much more serious and sort of lay out the things that socially and politically concern him the most. But that chorus does sort of show where serious politics and the sort of tongue-in-cheek culture of hip-hop intersect.
On the other hand, very few presidents of Haiti have completed their terms, have they?
That's true. This is, you know, and again, I think that's one of the things that he hopes he can bring. He was a kid. Haiti was, as we point out in the piece, you know, a byword for boat people, AIDS, dictators. And, you know, and now that he, you know, that he's come of age himself, he feels that this is a chance to change that whole image of Haiti and to make, you know, government less of a sort of a shadowy pursuit here and much, governance that's out in the open and more progressive. And, you know, again, he feels that someone from the diaspora perhaps is better positioned to do that than someone from, you know, inside the political elite here. It almost sort of sounds like the throw out the bums movement we've got going on politically in the United States
okay.
right now.
Tom Padgett with the Time magazine, now in Port-au-Prince. We apologize for the quality of that cell phone communication, but we thought the story was important enough, and I think it was very understandable. It's good to have you on our program. Today's program produced today by Katie Cooper with Daryl Satzman and Gary Scott, our technical director Mike Newport, managing producer Carolyn Radziner. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.